double burden of these attacks at work and in unpaid child and elder care and other domestic labour to fill the gaps that welfare cuts have created. Alongside the undermining of trade union struggles has gone the rise of individualism, reflected in neoliberal feminism from people like Hillary Clinton to Oprah Winfrey. Yet neoliberalism has not been able to obliterate working class women's resistance. So Diane Fields has been active since the early 1970s in many campaigns, such as those for Aboriginal rights and against the war in Iraq and Afghanistan, and also in the Refugee Action Coalition. She is the author of From Exploitation to Resistance and Revolt, Working Class, and Equal Pay, the Insurance Industry Struggle, 1973 to 75. She has also contributed to the Marxist Left Review, which is a social alternative theoretical journal, on topics such as labour, Greens and independence in government, and also the impact of women's changing role in the workforce. I actually tried to get a couple of those copies, but unfortunately the book shop has been packed away, but you can actually access these online as well too, but you should take out a subscription and support this project. Her talk today, as I said, is entitled Overworked and Underpaid, Women and Neoliberalism. Please welcome Diane.
All right, well, I was thinking about, you know, this whole question about neoliberalism, which is not going to be new to anyone in this room. What is neoliberalism? What do we think about it? You know, all boo and hiss now. Pretty straightforward. That was meant to be rhetorical, but yeah. You're obviously very obedient at this late stage of the conference. But I was thinking, and part of what I want to do in the talk is just to sort of look a bit at how the kind of continuity and change, if you like, in women's role under capitalism in its kind of boom phase, and how that role has been impacted by the attacks and so on that characterised the neoliberal era since capitalism went back into crisis in the mid-1970s. And I was thinking in relation to this about a book that kind of marked really the early years of what was to become eventually the women's liberation movement. It was a book by a woman called Betty Friedan, called The Feminine Mystique. And the book came out in 1963. And in it, she describes the kind of vague, dreadful feeling of what it is to be a housewife, to be a not quite human person by virtue of being a woman. And she raises a question that kind of comes again and again in the book, the question that women ask themselves in that situation, is that all there is? And that resonates, I think, with women today as well. And it really resonated with me on the evening of the New South Wales state election. The New South Wales state election, the existing Liberal Party Premier Gladys Berejiklian was re-elected. Woohoo. But my lack of enthusiasm was not reflected on the television screen. First, we had Linda Burney, long-standing ex-minister of the Labor government in New South Wales, congratulating Gladys Berejiklian, her sister, very strange sisterhood, and then Sarah Hanson-Young from the Greens saying the same thing. What a great thing for women that this appalling neoliberal conservative woman, Gladys Berejiklian, had been re-elected to run the state of New South Wales. Really, is that all there is? So that's just to sort of get you in the mood. I'm afraid I've tried to take out too many of the statistics and so on, but I think in order to understand the shifting way in which neoliberalism has impacted on women of the working class, we do need to have some sort of theory, and we also need to have some facts, although I've tried to keep the numbers to a minimum. Comrades want to read the article that I wrote in the Marxist Left Review a few years ago about women at work and the effect of working life on the family and so on. There are lots of numbers in that. Okay, so where do we begin? Well, let's begin with a few basics. Women are today a permanent part of the wage workforce, but women's work remains generally low paid and undervalued. Sexist attitudes and practices are rampant in and out of the workplace, and the majority of domestic labour, especially childcare, is still done by working class women. Like all the working class, neoliberal attacks over the past 30 to 40 years have placed the lives of working class women under increasing pressure. but capitalism's needs are not going to be served by a return to the 1950s. So things that have changed, I think, are immensely important in understanding the way in which working and family life for working class women is shaped today. Despite considerable changes, two things do remain constant. One is the role of the family in raising the next generation of workers and maintaining the ability to work of the existing generations of both sexes at little cost to employers. The other constant is the employer's need for women's labour as a source of profit. So in countries like Australia, this means that childcare is not going to totally disappear, far from it. It will just become more and more expensive and we will bear the cost. Nor do we face the prospect in this country that abortion will become unavailable. They want us to be able to limit our families wholly and solely so we can keep making profits for them. But this does not mean, as events in Poland and the United States, for example, show, that a tax on what rights there are will not be made. So, neoliberalism. Really, capitalism's response to the return to crisis to the system since the 1970s, following the long post-war economic boom. It does mean that a tax on workers' rights at work, state cuts to social spending, and a series of ideological shifts will put more pressure on working class families, and that this will be borne disproportionately by women. So our starting point in understanding the oppression of women under capitalism is Marx's argument that the ideas and practices which shape every area of life are rooted in social production. By the post-war boom throughout the world, more and more women of both the working and middle classes were being drawn into paid employment, including during their childbearing years, and that was something of a shift. Without acknowledging the importance of this, you can only have a partial understanding of the reality of women's oppression under capitalism. But as the needs of production have changed, so has women's unpaid labour in the home, and this is no accident. Capitalism has been able to adapt both ideologically and materially to the decline in the number of full-time housewives because the system as a whole has benefited from that. Nor should we think that the return of crisis means that women are a disposable reserve army of labour to be pulled into work during war or when times are booming, but then the first to be laid off in peacetime or in times of economic recession. That's not been the case at all. Actually, as the system has returned to crisis, the requirements of the bosses for women's labour in various different ways have remained very high. Domestic labour then takes the form it does, precisely because of its connection with capitalist production. The sexist stereotypes that blight women's lives are then rooted in the family, but constantly enforced and reinforced in the interaction between domestic life and life in the world of work. Why the family? Well, the family is the place, as I said, where the next generation of workers is cared for, socialised, nursed, fed and clothed in the home at little cost to the capitalist class. The existing generation of workers of both sexes are refreshed. Their needs, both material and emotional, to some degree at least, are replenished so that, as far as the bosses are concerned, replenished enough so that they're fit to continue to work. And so family life contains an invisible world of hard work, an invisible world of hard work for the benefit of the nation's capitalists, even though they would have us believe that it's for our own personal benefit. Employers want a free ride on the backs of the working class, and in particular, women bear the greater load in the working class. And they want that free ride both in their own nation, that is, we have to do it where we live, but they also want that free ride from the childbearing of women elsewhere. Think about migration, think about indenture schemes and so on. You get this free labour, all the work and so on has been done and paid for somewhere else, then you get the outcome of that. So the bosses are constantly bludging off the working class. And they want to keep these costs to a minimum. It's vital for them, the bigger the burden that the capitalists can force onto the family in the form of this unpaid labour, the smaller the drain on what they have to contribute from their profits. And they regard everything, state revenue and so on, they regard that as theirs as well. And particularly as the rate of profit goes down, that is a process that they want to make sure goes ahead with as much being done at their behest but not at their cost as possible. And so capitalists despite this being a supposedly private sphere of workers' lives, capitalists have got a direct interest in this supposedly private sphere. But the way in which that interest plays out changes, because capitalism continually changes its demands on the working class family in order to benefit the needs of the system at any particular time. So I want to move on to look at what does this look like today. Before I do, a couple of background things, because I think, in theory, capitalism could do without the family. But concretely, I think this is not going to happen. Concretely, it would cause such an upheaval to do so that it's hard to imagine it ever being able to happen. Not only would the level of investment be enormous, think of the problem of the crisis already, unlikely to make all these new investments in the current situation, but I think the investment would be enormous. The subsequent competitive disadvantage for any state that introduced such a thing would be tremendous. And alongside that, there would be such immense ideological turmoil that would result that I think we can safely say that the family is not going anywhere. And in the context of the present global economic crisis, capitalism's dynamic is in fact in the opposite direction. Far from socialising and replacing the tasks carried out in the family, the system increasingly places further burdens on it. The family, which increasingly includes single parents and same-sex couples, whatever its composition, it remains the key institution for the reproduction of labour power as a range of social benefits are withdrawn in the interests of profitability. And despite the changes that neoliberalism has wrought, the family is still a crucial prop for the system, both materially and ideologically. It sustains the stereotypes of women's true role being that of wife and mother, even though in the neoliberal period we might have to add to our true roles of wives and mothers a bit of raunch culture. But these true roles are used to justify low wages for millions of workers, women workers the world over, to create sexist divisions amongst workers, and to undermine women's confidence in a thousand ways. And this hampers working class unity and working class organisation while providing the ideological justification for family responsibility for a range of people that the system really doesn't care about because they're not yet profitable. So an ideological justification for family responsibility for children, and children, as we'll see in a bit, very widely defined, family responsibility for the elderly or disabled relatives. All of this because healthcare funding and other social welfare benefits are being cut. It also impacts the way women participate in the paid workforce. The intersection, as I said, between family and working life is, if anything, accelerated by neoliberalism. Okay, so the labour market, but not just the labour market as some abstract given. The labour market and the state of the class struggle exert considerable influence on the supposedly private internal workings of families, including, just think about the way in which that happens, important decisions about fertility or who should forgo all or part of their income to do unpaid housework and childcare, whether or not workers have access to the necessary conditions for reproduction at all. A job with a wage sufficient to support parents and children shapes the world of the family and narrows the choices that are open to working class women and men. And so neoliberalism's attacks on the working class have reshaped both working and family life for women worldwide. Now, if you think about what the worldwide labour market looks like, you will understand why I'm not going to talk about the worldwide labour market. That I'm going to largely illustrate this argument by reference to Australia, although it has many similarities with other OECD countries, at least. Before I do, though, one useful piece of background, I think it says a great deal about the way in which these sort of stereotypes, the kind of almost permanence, the way in which they're so deeply embedded in our society, the stereotype of the divide between the breadwinner, generally male, and the homemaker, generally female, in our society. Because actually, in OECD countries, this sharp divide was widespread only between about 1890 and 1940. That is, a 50-year atypical period has become the touchstone for why it must be like it is. And so that, you know, that deeply embedded stereotype is derived not from anything kind of natural or even frequent. Now, changes since World War II did shift the balance between women's role in the family and their exploitation as part of the paid workforce. The long economic boom of the 1950s and 60s saw women's participation in paid work rise. Why? Not because of anything to do with, you know, enriching their lives or anything like that, but as employers were keen to draw increasing numbers of women into the workplace to meet their increased labour needs. And despite such boom times being a thing of the distant past for Australian capitalism, employer demands for women's paid labour have continued to accelerate. 46% of the Australian workforce are women, and actually worldwide a majority of the working class are women. But we could, I think we should contrast, just to sort of get a picture of how neoliberalism has impacted on working class women, contrast the neoliberal period with when capitalism was booming. And 50 years ago, the majority of Australians who worked were men working full-time. Most full-time male workers worked well into their 60s, sometimes beyond. And if they were not working, most were out looking for work until that advanced age. The picture now is very different. Far more people work part-time or in temporary or casual jobs. Retirement ages vary much more, with a greater proportion of men not participating in the labour force at all once they are older than 55, again on the scrap heap. 50 years ago, only 30% of Australian workers were women. So another change in this same period has been a considerable growth in the number of mothers in the paid workforce. And while part-time work has increased as a proportion of the workforce overall, it's one of the key features of the employment of women with children. Another factor, and this is one that has not changed, where women are clustered in the working class, regardless of the nature of the work, employers know they can get away with paying less. And this affects all workers, not just women. The bosses, you know, summed up, the bosses will always say to the men, well, if you don't like it, we can get the Sheilas in. So, low wages, due to the fact that sections of the workforce are largely female and that women's work is undervalued, are one contributor to the gender wage gap. Now, that is something that has changed. It's a global phenomenon of the neoliberal era that the gender wage gap is stubbornly stuck. But also, within the neoliberal era, sometimes periods of narrowing of the gender wage gap are not a good thing. Easy to understand if you look at the world from the perspective of class rather than the perspective of gender. Because one way the gender wage gap can close is that male wages go down. That's exactly what happened in the United States in the 1990s. Men's real wages were driven down. The gender wage gap did close, not something to celebrate. And of course, neoliberalism has had an effect on family life as well. Although the majority of women are part of the paid labour force, as I said, despite considerable changes in attitudes, the family ideal and the assumption that women are better suited to domestic responsibilities, including childcare, those things live on. And so the reactionary idea that a woman's place is in the home has not gone away. It's changed its form. We have more caveats around it, but it's still well and truly alive. And neoliberal responses to the crisis of profitability mean that in many ways it's been reinforced, both ideologically and materially. Problems of childcare, work and family life are ultimately seen as the responsibilities of individual women or at best of individual families. So again, the kind of the ideological consequences of neoliberalism, the idea summed up by Margaret Thatcher, that well-known great woman, that there is no such thing as society, that is, we're all individuals, repeat after me, we're all individuals, that idea is really one of the hallmarks of neoliberalism. And it's been reflected in this idea that all of these issues to do with family life, it's up to you. But how individual women experience all of this is not uniform. We don't need Margaret Thatcher to tell us that. How individual women experience this is determined by their class position. And despite the protestations of that well-known feminist International Monetary Fund head, Christine Lagarde, that even ruling class women like herself can't have it all, it has been the case over the last few decades that for a minority of wealthy women, things have changed dramatically and in a positive way for them. The rise of what we might call neoliberal feminism. Now, of course, sadly for such women, at the top of the class structure, it's still the case that women are not equally represented with the men of their class. They're always whinging about there's not enough of them on the board of directors and so on. But the burdens of work and childcare do not weigh on them as they do on working class women. And while we might say that wealthy women are not the only audience for books like former Google senior executive Sheryl Sandberg's dreadful book, Lean In, Women, Work and the Will to Lead, it's not the will to power, dreadful book, obviously the audience for this book is not just women of the capitalist class, but those are the only women for whom its message of power feminism, that a woman's place is wherever she wants to be, as Sandberg says, is actually true. It's only true for them. Alison Wolfe, who wrote a book called The XX Factor, argues that far from what Christine Lagarde and Sheryl Sandberg would have us believe, that a new female elite now enjoys a high degree of equality with the wealthiest men, while having nothing in common with the vast majority of women. She points out that the increased income inequality, again, a factor, you know, well known as one of the markers of the neoliberal era, increased income inequality of recent decades, though it has hit non-elite men, as she calls them, particularly hard, is not just a male phenomenon. Income inequality amongst women has also risen sharply. And since the mid-1960s, the percentage of total female earnings going to women in the top earnings group has doubled. No other group of women can say that. In other words, class continues to divide women. And the intensification of the class struggle from the boss's side, with the return to the system of crisis, means that the women of the ruling class, like Lagarde, Sandberg, or our own Gina Rinehart, the wealthiest woman in Australia, possibly the wealthiest person in Australia at the moment, and the growing number of female billionaires, have a clear interest in anti-working class policies of austerity and anti-unionism. And it's not just the difference between the working class, the vast majority, and the capitalist class, the capitalist women right at the top. Middle class women in management roles play their part in enforcing the interests of capital against the interests of the workers whose labour they control. The emphasis of some supporters of women's rights on small numbers of women breaking through the glass ceiling or on promotion opportunities for those towards the top of the scale, again, has little to offer most women workers, and even less really than in the boom period when these ideas first began to have some purchase. The class interest of those women managers is in keeping wages and working conditions down in direct opposition to the interests of working class women. And so I want to move now briefly to the way in which neoliberalism has also affected the family. Because the family as a form of reproduction is not static. It's moulded by the needs of capitalism. This is not a one-way process, but as I said before, a reciprocal one of constant interaction. Decreasing family size, due in part to improved contraception, helped make it possible for women workers to enter paid work at the behest of employers. The experience of work and, in the neoliberal period, the increasing need for the second wage to keep the family afloat then affect the family in other ways. And I want to move on to talk about the question of unpaid labour in the home, as comrades would know, very much dominated by the idea that this is largely going to be women's responsibility, whether or not the actual individuals in any family unit wish that or otherwise, just because of the unequal pay and so on. Unpaid labour in the home is excluded from most official measures of economic activity, but it's been estimated in Australia, and I think this is probably, again, generally the case across the OECD, that if it had to be paid for, it would amount to the value of about half of gross domestic product. You can see why they don't want to pay. So childcare, for example. In the absence of easily accessible workplace provisions for family responsibilities, many working parents have to rely on adjusting their working arrangements to address their caring responsibilities. The care that is available is often the trifecta of unaffordable, at unsuitable hours, and in a location that you can't get to. The price paid for childcare has increased at three times the general rate of inflation since 2009, and so for many workers, what is euphemistically called informal childcare, which is generally the extended family, especially the women members of the extended family, comes into play as a matter of necessity. It fills the gaps between the childcare that's needed and what workers can access on the market. Once again, individual responsibility is meant to rule. Why couldn't you organise it better? Why couldn't you find someone in the family who would do it? Individualism writ large. But of course, in reality, the unfavourable balance of class forces is what rules. Regardless of their legal entitlements, many workers who are not content with their current work arrangements do not make use of their right to request flexibility at work because their jobs are insecure, or because they believe that their supervisors will view such requests negatively, or because there's no history of flexible work in their workplace. Add to that a workplace history of sexual harassment, discrimination against pregnant workers, working carers or older employees, discrimination against those affected by domestic violence, the message of neoliberalism to women in the workforce is shut up. So, capitalists want working class families to participate in paid work, but they also want to minimise their own costs as much as possible. Despite the introduction of 18 weeks of parental leave paid by the state, not paid by employers, at the minimum wage in 2011, there is still little in the way of workplace provision for family responsibilities or childcare. Basically, people have to just find creative ways to use whatever leave they can get and so on to manage all of this. Again, the idea of individual responsibility. Interestingly, some of the figures about this, the responsibility for children, have very wide definitions. They include costs for children up to the age of 24. Probably lots of you in the room under 24 who do not regard yourself as children. But this indicates another important change in family life wrought by the boss's neoliberal attacks. A long-term decline in both apprenticeships and teenage employment, plus increasing years of post-school education, mean that many children, so-called, remain financially dependent on parents well into adulthood. Again, the parents pay, the system doesn't. In 1996, in order to encourage parental support of unemployed teenagers, the Howard government restricted or abolished all allowances for teenagers aged between 16 and 20. Do your parents love you? They'll pay. And there are so many other examples we could look at. Subsequently, the Gillard Labor government removed single parents whose children had reached the ancient age of 8 years. So sometimes you're a child up to 24. Sometimes you stop being a child at eight. Just depends what costs money. And so the Gillard government removed single parents whose children reached the age of 8 years from the single parent benefit. This was on the same day that Gillard made her famous speech about how she wouldn't be lectured about misogyny by Tony Abbott. She would just carry it out. Okay. And so all of this means that the capitalist class, they want caring, whether it's for 20-something dependent adults, children or the elderly, to be rearranged with as little cost to them as possible. And governments have been happy to oblige. In 2009, and I'm sure the figures have got worse, 12% of the population of Australia, that was 2.6 million people in Australia, had caring responsibilities for people other than children, such as a family member or a friend with a disability or illness or suffering frailty due to old age. And the provision of unpaid care has, of course, a significant impact back on workforce participation, especially for women who are much more likely than men to be the primary carers in the course of this. And so, I mean, this is just one way in which undermining the stereotype of women as full-time homemakers doesn't mean that women don't still do most of the housework and especially the childcare. And as I said, this is not a choice that individuals make freely, but a choice that is constrained by things such as the availability of care and also the level of wages and the availability of work in the first place. There is increased pressure on the family, and unpaid household work such as cooking, cleaning, shopping and caring for children takes up a substantial and increasing proportion of workers' lives in the neoliberal era. Nature of work in the family has changed. Here's a 1978 description, which will be very foreign to all of you except those who are old, and even probably foreign to some of us. It's a 1978 description of women's work. What do women do? Converting raw materials into meals. Raw materials into meals, not takeaway. Soap powder and hot water into cleansing agents. Fabrics into curtains. Flour, icing sugar and paper streamers into children's birthday parties. There you go. Doesn't fit most working class families today. We simply don't have the time. From the need for car ownership if childcare and work are to be combined, through household appliances from washing machines to slow cookers that will cook the meal while you're at work, to takeaway food, cleaning services and childcare itself, a range of expenditures are now necessary parts of family life and the responsibility, once again, of individual families, transforming families into units of consumption as well as of that kind of production of use values that used to be much more the case. Okay, I'm going to wind up. Individualism reigns in obscuring the class-based attacks on working women. But I don't want to end on such a negative note, because it's not entirely gloom and doom, even with the state of the class struggle in Australia at the moment. The changes in women's position have not all been entirely to the capitalist liking or plan. In particular, Marx and Engels' famous aphorism in the Communist Manifesto that by creating the working class, capitalism creates its own grave diggers, applies just as much to the potential collective power available to women workers as to men. Being part of the paid workforce also makes possible the breaking down of some of the divisions within the working class due to sexism. At work, Australian women are now almost half of all the trade union members. And even though the union movement is at a low ebb, that means there are several hundred thousand women who are trade union members. By far the biggest women's movement in Australia today. And while levels of industrial action remain woefully low, historically low, it is not the case that what militancy there is resides entirely with stereotypically male unions. Far from it. Coal mining and construction might often account for the highest rates of strike per worker, but it's now frequently the case that the total strike days of the two industries called education and training on the one hand, and healthcare and social assistance on the other, account for the majority of industrial action in any given quarter. And this reflects strikes by groups of workers like teachers and nurses, groups that are historically largely female. And we only have to think of the involvement of women in the teacher strikes in the United States in the recent past to see the potential that could be embodied there. And all this matters because industrial action can change not only the perceptions of women workers about themselves, but also challenge one of the most pervasive sexist stereotypes, that of female passivity and obedience. And neoliberal victim blaming really has no place when struggle takes off. So to conclude, capitalism keeps on restructuring women's oppression in the family. The key factor in this is the impact of women's role in the workplace. Women are now a permanent and significant part of the workforce. However, economic crisis places increasing burdens upon actual families, so domestic labour and the fact that women do most of it remains a crucial aspect of contemporary capitalism. Now, why does this all matter? Well, for Marxists, any examination of the realities of women's oppression is directed to helping answer the question, how can women be liberated? That's what we want, no half measures. And if women's oppression is rooted in the family, and the family's key function is the reproduction of labour power for capital, then there can be no women's liberation under capitalism. The struggles of the 1960s and 1970s did win women a series of important rights, but without confronting the exploitative system of capitalism itself, then these rights could always be rolled back, and as we've seen, they have been. As those rights come under pressure and the burden on the working class family increases, to settle for this is to accept that progress is only available to a minority of wealthy women, because that's what's happened. For working class women, there are no individual solutions. And so Marx's grave diggers of capitalism are not, and never were, only men. Women workers can fight, like all of our class, to overthrow capitalism, and that's the fundamental source of our oppression.